This podcast was recorded on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We acknowledge and pay our respect to elders past and present.
The Sundays of my life are all the life I own.
From director Ken Hannum and starring Jack Thompson, 1975's Sunday Too Far Away focuses on a group of shearers in the lead-up to strike action in the mid-1950s.
I was at Aramac Downs in 51.
Who do you reckon rung that shit?
Foley, of course.
The film follows Foley, a so-called top dog shearer, who returns reluctantly to a remote sheep station, despite having dreams of leaving the industry for good.
On the way to the shed.
You were never ever coming back.
There, he engages in the typical shearer's life.
Now, have an haircut. Go on, stay still, and we'll knock some of the wool off.
Come on.
Characterised by both camaraderie and fierce competition, hard drinking and laconic humour.
So we don't want to do the wrong thing. Like, for example, getting pissed, too crook to start work tomorrow.
But this often masks deep feelings of loneliness for these men, who struggle to find meaning as cogs in the machine of a hugely significant but waning national export industry. In this episode of Seeing Green, we explore how Sunday Too Far Away engages in a particular representation of the environment and animals, making connections with contemporary industrial practices. And to flesh out these issues, I'm joined by two highly credentialed experts. First up, Professor Therese Davis, the Department Chair of Media and Communications at Swinburne University of Technology. Therese has extensive experience researching and teaching film and media studies at universities across Australia. Her collaborative work has influenced new understandings of Australian cinema and Indigenous Australian screen media. And she's currently one of the lead researchers on the ARC-funded project this podcast is part of, titled Remaking the Australian Environment Through Documentary, Film and Television. Therese is also the co-executive producer of this very podcast, and it's extra special to have her debuting behind the microphone. Therese, welcome to Seeing Green.
Thanks, Dylan. It's a pleasure to be here.
And so what led you to doing this current research about Australian film and TV and the environment?
I think it stems from having worked with this archive of Australian cinema for a long time and identifying that it's been looked at through particular frames, particularly the kind of landscape tradition and landscape as part of the Australian mythology of myth of origin. And what we wanted to do was go back and look at that through another lens, which is the lens of the environment. So not landscape, but environments.
We are also joined in this episode by Professor Ruth Abbey, Department Chair of Social Sciences, also over at Swinburne University of Technology. Ruth is a political theorist whose expansive research includes the philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche and Charles Taylor, as well as liberal and feminist political thought. And of particular significance for our discussion today is her interest in animal ethics. Ruth, I'm so excited to see where your knowledge leads us today. Welcome to Seeing Green.
Thanks, Dylan, and thanks to Therese for inviting me to participate in this conversation.
And so, drum roll, why did you want to explore Sunday Too Far Away?
Well, when Therese and I were exploring the idea of bringing me into a conversation in this podcast series, we started to think about movies with animals, and Sunday Too Far Away just popped into my head because it certainly is a movie which has animals in it, and we just took it from there, and that was serendipitous because, as I hope today's conversation will disclose, it's a very rich film. And looking at it through a less anthropocentric lens than most commentators have taken so far, you see some new things by looking at it through a less anthropocentric lens, but some old things also show up in a new light.
Yeah, and before we get into that discussion and pull on some of those threads, I wonder if you can give us a bit more of an insight into your particular research into animal ethics.
Well, most of my work so far on animal ethics has been looking at how political philosophers can make room for animals within their approaches. And that takes us so far, but there are also some significant limitations on what political philosophers have to offer, because their work has always been so anthropocentric. They haven't always given animals the attention they deserve.
Yeah, well, so happy to have you both joining us for this episode of Seeing Green today. Let's now transport ourselves to the dusty environs of a remote Queensland sheep station in 1955.
Do you mind telling me where I am?
On your way to a shed.
Jane, come away to win easily from Magic Carpet. If finish well, but then far too late. Then
Ruth, given that you have selected this film for us to analyse today, what's your particular relationship to it? I mean, when did you first see it, and how did it resonate with you at that time?
Oh, I saw it not long after it first came out, and I didn't think too much of it at the time. I thought that it was a film about men, it was a film about mateship. I found it a strange film in many ways because it doesn't make a lot of concessions to outsiders when it brings you into this very unusual subculture. And as Teresa's just suggested, it's kind of an early version of the gig economy, because the shearers go around to different sheds and get employed in that way. And then I watched it again when I recently returned to Australia in 2019, and my impression hadn't changed much. I think I was struck second time around by how dominated it is by men. But it was really only reviewing it and viewing it yet again through the lens of animals that I saw this incredible richness in the film that had escaped me on my first two viewings.
Yeah, and the opening scene features Foley, the main character played by Jack Thompson, driving his VW Beetle, looking sort of very tired in the rearview mirror. He then crashes and flips his car. And this scene doesn't really serve a primary purpose in the plot, I suppose, but it is where we're introduced to the place that he's in, the landscape, with some really affecting camera work. What is the significance of that scene, do you think, Therese, in terms of establishing Foley's relationship to this place and the land that he is existing in for, you know, a period of time?
I could talk for hours about this opening scene, Dylan. I think you've touched on something there, which it really doesn't have anything to do with the plot. It is about establishing place, and it's about establishing genre, and that this is an Australian outback film. And we see all the familiar iconography, the burning sun, the heat, the red earth, the kind of road moving into a kind of endless horizon. The billabong, it's all kind of there, but there's something different going on, and the film immediately wants to sort of shock us into a different relation to that mythology, which is the sudden car crash. When you're seeing it for the first time, you don't sort of see it coming. The crash is really interesting because it's not like other crashes in Australian films. This is not Mad Max. This is a kind of a mundane crash, if you like. This is someone who's fallen asleep at the wheel. It's really interesting because in the Australian cinema tradition, the car often represents the male hero. And his relation to the car is kind of symbolic of who he is and his identity. But it's also the relation to the landscape, because the car moves through the landscape. But what we've got here is something different.
Yeah, interesting. And Ruth, for you, is there anything in particular that stands out in that opening scene?
Oh, there's a lot in that opening scene that stands out. Just in terms of the environment, at some point we get a double view of the landscape around Foley, because we see it through the windscreen and we see it through the rear vision mirror, which is very, very striking. The other thing I would add to this scene is that we see a beer bottle on the ground. It's not clear whether the beer bottle has fallen out of the car, but I think we're meant to infer that it has. And so that suggests to me that it was not just drowsiness and heat that led Foley to roll the car. He might have also been partly intoxicated. And intoxication is just a crucial theme through the whole film, where, you know, when the men aren't shearing, many of them are drinking.
What I think is interesting here is that the crash foreshadows Foley's crash. So it is about what is about to happen is that he's going to fail as the gun shearer, and that this film is really about the failure of a particular masculinity that is embodied in the kind of iconic figure of the shearer. So I think that's a really important part of this film. The other thing that I would say here is that there is this short but significant use of a sort of electronic didgeridoo sound in the first, maybe it's only about 20 seconds. So the use of the didgeridoo here sort of is also part of placing this film and particularly placing it in the mythic Australian environment. And it's part of what I've looked at before, which is the role that cinema played in sort of reinforcing terra nullius, because this is this fragment of a kind of dispossessed people, so it reinforces the disappearance of Indigenous Australians from this country, from their country. Yeah, I think this is an important thing to think about, these outback films, that cinema actually was a very powerful tool in the colonial project for telling these stories of Indigenous disappearance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, as you say, the electronic didgeridoo sort of hints at an awareness of dispossession and the removal or, attempted eradication of Indigenous people across these lands. But there aren't any sort of obvious Indigenous characters in the film that at least are revealed to us as being Indigenous. And this film, you know, as you say, coming at a time where the land rights movement is taking off, and also coming 10 years after Vincent Lingiari's very famous walk-off from the Wave Hill cattle station, which was raising awareness about labour exploitation on particular sort of livestock stations in Australia as well.
The first thing we see about the sheep is them swarming across this landscape, and it's a very beautiful vision. Filmically, it's wonderfully done, but it completely naturalizes the sheep. It effaces the fact that the wool industry in Australia is a colonial project. The movie does sometimes draw attention to that. The contractor's name is King. And we do hear through the radio in some snatches across the film that the price of wool is going down, or rather the prosperity bonus is being removed.
In Brisbane this week, the State Industrial Court is sitting to consider an application by the Grazing Association to have the prosperity bonus for shearing removed. The bonus of 10% was introduced last year following record prices for wool. With a slump in prices this year, graziers have asked that the bonus be removed.
And at one point we get one of those reports, and the very next report is about the engagement of Princess Margaret that the palace has just announced.
Buckingham Palace officials are expected to make an announcement today on Princess Margaret's reported engagement with Group Captain Peter Townsend.
So the film doesn't entirely erase white Australia's colonial status. It's there in some suggestive ways, but for the most part, yes, the sheep are naturalized, and there's not a single Indigenous animal that I can see in the film. As I said, we hear the birds, we don't see them. There are some horses in that opening scene, a brown horse and a white horse, and there's a gingery dog at the end of the movie who might be a bit dingo-like, but we see no native animals in this movie at all.
Yeah, and I mean, in terms of the role of Foley in this film, when he arrives at the pub, we hear that he's there somewhat reluctantly. The Ivy, the barmaid, says, "You were never, ever coming back," to which Foley replies, "I've come back, but I'm not going to bust my gut," and then goes on to say that he has plans to put a lot of money away. "I reckon in 4 years I can have enough to go down the coast, buy myself a prawning boat."
"I've come back, but I'm not going to bust my gut. I'm going to shear nice and steady. 150 a day. Gonna ease up on the grog, put a little bit away, put a lot away. I reckon in 4 years I can have enough. Go down the coast, buy myself a prawning boat. What do you think of that?"
"Very commendable."
"Don't you believe me?"
So what do you think of that, Therese, in terms of his somewhat reluctance at being in this place in the context of that, you know, push colonial push that was happening at the time and the use of labour to support this burgeoning national industry.
Yeah, I think that that's really interesting, this part of the plot, that this is a return and it's a reluctant return. And I think it represents the way in which labour works in this industry, in the pastoral industry, where it is circular, it's seasonal. The shearers come and they go, but they keep moving in circles, they travel in circles. So it's not like a destination like the pioneer where they move across the land, find a place and settle down. These men are caught in this terrible circle, dreaming of elsewhere. So they're not thinking about settling in the outback. They're actually dreaming of making enough money to buy a house on the coast. There's an interesting parallel with the sheep that they're shearing, because we know part of this industry, it won't function unless there's enough land to move the sheep around, because what the sheep do is destroy the vegetation in one area, then they move on, then they moved on again. So there is this massive land footprint for these stations where the sheep are moved around in a circular movement as well. So the organized contract labor and the organized movement of sheep around great tracts of land.
Yeah, would you like to pull on those threads, Ruth?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think it's very interesting that throughout the film we see these kinships between Foley and the sheep, but we also see some important distinctions between the men and the sheep. So just in terms of kinship, Foley has this mop of thick, blonde, curly hair. His hair is very sheep-like. In one of the early scenes that Therese referred to, where he's at the billabong, what's he doing? He's shaving. What is shearing but shaving? Shearing is shaving sheep. Say that five times quickly. And one of the things I spotted through one of my later views of the movie is that almost all of the men are clean-shaven. There are a number of men with facial hair, but we can count them on less than one hand. Garth and Quinn the cook both have facial hair, and there are two extras in pub scenes that have facial hair, but the vast majority of the shearers are clean-shaven. So they shave themselves and they shave the sheep. So there's a certain kinship that Therese has just pointed to about the mobility of the sheep and the men. But there are also a number of ways in which the film brings out the differences between the sheep and the men, which is very interesting. And I would also add that the men don't feel the kinship with the sheep that the film shows us. The men are quite indifferent towards the fate of the sheep in the shearing. The men see the sheep simply as ways of earning income.
Such fascinating insights. And I'm sort of thinking about that scene featuring Mr. Dawson where he's peeping into the shed because he's got this prized ram that's worth a whole lot of money, and he tells the shearers that they'll earn double and a half that day, but he's really making sure that they're not maiming the sheep, harming it in any particular way.
You all know how easy it is for a money-hungry shearer to incapacitate a ram. Consequently, instead of the usual double rate, I've decided to pay double plus a half.
What Mr. Dawson's saying is, these rams are worth a quid, so be careful with their pistols and be careful with their knackers.
What do you make of that in terms of the relationship between the humans and the sheep themselves in Sunday Too Far Away?
There's a whole lot there. So Cocky Dawson cares about the sheep, partly because they're an investment for him. And it's not just that single prize-winning ram that's worth a lot. He says that all of the other rams at Timbaroo, which is a stud property, would be worth half that much at least. So they're very valuable. And as a sign of their value, as you said, he freely gives them extra money to shear these sheep. So they get a bonus just by agreeing to be careful with the sheep. So that's how valuable they are. But the shearers don't want him in the shed. And even though he notionally is the employer and he notionally holds all the cards, they succeed in ejecting him from the sheep and from the shed. And he's reduced to trying to peer in through the cracks. He is concerned about the sheep. And there's one scene where he's dealing with a shearer called Basher, who has had to wrangle the sheep down in a fairly rough sort of way. And Cocky Dawson says,
"Careful.
Let him up, give him a rest." And Basher says, "I just got the bastard down."
Let him up, let him up. I just got the bastard down. Let him rest.
And that just, it gives you an insight into the fact that the men just see the sheep as pieces in a quasi-industrial production line. These living beings have been brought in and just fed into this production line in a really harsh way. And as I said, the men don't seem to care much about that.
Backs on the pond.
Backs on the pond.
But another scene where we see concern and compassion for the sheep is when Miss Dawson comes into the shed to witness the shearing. And she has, through a bargain with Foley, gained entree that her father was not allowed. She's allowed to sit there and watch one of the runs. She watches until morning tea.
You invited her. She invited herself. What favour?
And when she arrives, at first the men are playing around and one of them holds a knife up to the other one's throat.
Will you leave, please, Miss Dawson?
No.
But as the shearing actually starts, she becomes more and more distressed and concerned about what she sees. She sees the sheep being bloodied. She sees their rough handling. And so that scene, which starts off as being exciting and lighthearted, descends into one of concern and anxiety. And the audience can relate to Miss Dawson's concern and anxiety. We're encouraged to identify with the sheep in that scene. But what I also think the camera does is it both shows us that anxiety, but it assuages that anxiety, because there are many other scenes where we see the sheep surviving, enduring the shearing process. We don't see any of them killed during the shearing process accidentally. And in many of the scenes, we see headshots, close-ups of the sheep, and they're doing okay. So I think the camera both arouses that anxiety, but it reduces that anxiety that is intrinsic to the shearing process for the sheep.
I think what's interesting is that this film tries to recover this heroic moment where the heritage and mythology of the Australian nation as a pastoral nation, that the Australian nation was made on the back of sheep. And if we've got all these other films in the AFC genre recovering other kind of heroic moments in Australia's past, for example, Gallipoli, this film goes back to this moment where there's a major shift in Australia's self-identity. But what's interesting there is that it is a sleight of hand, because even though the economy changes, land use doesn't change. And if we start and think about it now, we still have a situation where 54% of Australian land is under pastoral leases and or some freehold. So the land use of pastoralism is massive in Australia. And this is compared to sort of 8% of land that is what we would call nature conservation. So it covers over what is the reality of land. So the discourse shifts to manufacturing, mining, which is this idea of coming in, extracting and leaving.
I think that's a really interesting point to lead into, Ruth, because we have had awareness raised about, you know, the devastation, I suppose, of the live animal trade through the visual representations, visual footage in documentary form. But, I mean, you've shown us how we can pull out these threads from such a celebrated film as Sunday Too Far Away in a way that hasn't really been done by many scholars and many researchers in the past. What is the role of the visual image in raising awareness and consciousness of some of these practices?
Well, it's potentially very powerful because, as I've been suggesting, I think in many ways the camera encourages us to identify with the sheep, with those headshots of them, close-ups on their face. However, given what you've just been saying, one of the things that this movie elides is the role of this other face of the sheep industry, which is meat production. So we don't really see sheep being slaughtered for food in this movie. And my guess is that because it wouldn't have been so popular with the movie-going audience had we been seeing slaughter rather than shearing. And yet there are a couple of moments when the movie gestures towards the slaughter of sheep for food. There's one very powerful one where the cook, Quinn, is off going into a small shed. We see him carrying the dead body of a sheep, and it must be a sheep from Timbaroo. That animal has been shorn, but not in the way that we've seen the live animals being shorn. And the animal's skin is hung on a wire fence with some other ones. Jim. And then Quinn takes the dead animal in, and we don't see it being butchered, but we hear the carcass being pounded. And so that's a very powerful moment for those with eyes to see and ears to hear that draws attention to the meat component of the sheep industry. But for the most part, the movie does not attend to that, even though we see the men eating meat and they're no doubt eating the sheep that have been bred at Timbaroo.
At least try it.
Well, something that strikes me in analyses I've read of the film is that we're prompted to almost view the sheep as kind of a stand-in for these men and the men's relationship in some way. The shearers are talked about at one point in quite derogatory terms by Mr. Dawson, the owner of the station. But I wonder how you reflect on that, Therese, and the tendency to view animals in film almost as kind of a stand-in for human relationships and the drama that's going on in people's lives at a particular time.
I would just totally agree with Ruth here that it's doing two things. One, it does that, and but then there are just some really kind of disturbing images. One image for me is the scene in where one of the shearers is dancing with a shorn sheep, and the sheep is on its back legs and it's doing a kind of mock dance, which I think is where the shorn sheep is actually standing in for women. And a mockery of women, because these men, part of their relationship to their work is also a relationship to women. But I think that scene is a standout there, and I found it one of the most disturbing scenes in the film in terms of its the treatment of the animals, the mockery of the animal and the mockery of women.
I think that there's a reading of the way the men are positioned vis-a-vis the sheep that's a little bit different, not from what Teresa said, but from what many of the commentators have said, those who've paid any attention to this, that is. And I think one of the things that's interesting is that Timbaroo, as we've said, is a stud farm, and the male sheep are all going to be breeders. And that contrasts markedly with the men in this film. They do not have any sustained or successful domestic relationships. Some domestic relationships are gestured at in the movie, but we're not shown any. And most of these men are individual free-roaming men outside of family relationships. And the thing that would supposedly compensate for their lack of domestic relationships is the mateship. But the mateship is very brittle in this movie, I think. There's actually very little of it to fall back on. Instead of mateship, we see competition. So the men in Sunday Too Far Away, the shearers at least, have no mating and very little mateship. Whereas the animals are stud animals. They'll be going off to reproduce. And the animals are usually shown in scenes together. They're huddling together. They're touching one another. They're seemingly taking comfort from living in that herd setting.
I wanted to ask your thoughts, Therese, then, on the role of feature film versus documentary in connecting us with some of these really important issues. Because as you alluded to, Ruth, when a feature film is designed to, you know, primarily entertain in some way, there might be an effort to refrain from representing the real gore, I suppose, of, you know, the live animal trade or you know, using animals as part of industrial meat production, whereas documentary can lean into that, but often you have a captive audience who might sort of already be somewhat aware of those issues already. How do you reflect on those two different, I suppose, genres of film, Therese, and their ability to connect us and force us or compel us, I suppose, to engage with these issues that we've explored in relation to Sunday Too Far Away?
Well, the way that I might think about that is through the frame of my research with Dr. Romaine Morton on the history of Indigenous filmmaking in Australia, the rise and rise of Indigenous filmmaking. And at a certain point, the Indigenous branch of Screen Australia wanted to work on the big screen, not the small screen, and they put all of their resources into creating feature films and training Indigenous filmmakers in the feature space. The real aim or the drive in the Indigenous screen sector has been to make feature films. And I think this is because there is recognition of the power of these feature films to create a public sphere in which the public can work through major issues that they may not want to deal with in a documentary form. What's interesting is that two of the most significant feature films by our amazing array of Indigenous filmmakers at the moment go back to these histories of the outback. And we've got Sweet Country, which is all about recognising Indigenous labour in the frontier and, of course, slave labour in the origins of the pastoral industry. And then most recently, of course, we've got Leah Purcell's The Drover's Wife, which is talking about the relationships between Indigenous and non-Indigenous in those moments. And, you know, again, the drover as an itinerant worker around that circular kind of work, but bringing Indigenous presence into that outback story. For me, looking back at this film, it's almost impossible not to look at these rural outback spaces without thinking about climate change now. So there's just been such a massive shift in consciousness around these spaces since 1975, where you're still at this time telling stories about the way in which the heroic settler battles nature, climate, and this is where the risk in these endeavours is, so that they can grab this land, they get it for free. It is about dispossession. They can take great tracts of it. They just bring sheep on. So there's kind of low investment. It's not like mining. But the one thing they have is the risk of climate, and that's what they're battling. But there's no sense that what's going on there is that what they're, it's not just that they are affected by climate, but what's happening is that what they're doing affects climate, and the contribution of the pastoral industry to greenhouse gas emissions. And that's something that we're coming to terms with now, and this is where the questions of sustainability are coming in. But I just found it like you can't look at these scenes, these spaces anymore without thinking about that because of the discourse of climate change now.
It's been so enlightening having you as part of today's discussion of Sunday Too Far Away. Therese Davis and Ruth Abbey, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Dylan.
Thank you.
Seeing Green is made at Swinburne University of Technology and Monash University and is supported by an Australian Research Council Discovery Grant. Our executive producers are Professor Therese Davis and Associate Professor Belinda Smale. Production and mixing by Britta Jorgensen. Music by Ash Sterling and hosted by me, Dylan Bird. Follow, rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.